This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz in Washington. In about 10 minutes, President Obama is expected in the East Room at the White House for his first solo news conference since March. His focus, budget talks, the debt ceiling, and the economy. But the president is also likely to take questions on a broad range of topics, from Afghanistan to the NATO campaign in Libya, and perhaps on last week's gay marriage vote in New York. With me in the studio here is NPR's economics correspondent, John Itzi. John, good to have you.
Hi, Guy.
Our national political correspondent, Mar Lyson. Mar, welcome.
Thank you.
And our national security correspondent, Rachel Martin. Rachel, thank you.
Happy to be here.
Let me start with you, Mara. Lay out the details of some of the big issues the president plans to address here today.
I think the president is certainly going to address the economy and gas prices and unemployment. He will definitely get questions about the talks that are going on to cut the deficit in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. He'll get questions about the NATO campaign in Libya and the controversy in Congress about whether or not the War Powers Act applies to that conflict. He'll certainly get questions about Afghanistan. He recently announced a drawdown of troops that was a little faster than the military wanted, but slower than many members of Congress wanted. And there was a big attack in Kabul last night, so he certainly will be asked about that. Gay marriage, which is something the president says his views on that issue are evolving. We assume that that means they're evolving in the direction of supporting it, but they're not there yet. And New York State, of course, just passed, you know, made gay marriage legal. So he'll be pressed on that. I think he's going to be there's a huge range of questions. I also think for the president, the reason that he called this press conference today, he needs an opportunity to push back against the Republicans, particularly in these debt ceiling negotiations, where they say the Democrats are insisting on tax increases. The Democratic argument is, no, we're not trying to raise people's income tax rates. We're trying to get rid of tax loopholes and tax breaks for rich individuals or oil companies' special interests. And I think the White House feels it hasn't been able to make that argument strongly enough.
John Itzi, picking up on that point, the federal government has already hit its borrowing limit, right? The so-called debt ceiling. Normally, in the past, Congress has routinely approved increases in the ceiling. This time, it's different. As Mara just mentioned, many congressional Republicans say they'll only agree to an increase under certain conditions. Where do those negotiations now stand?
Well, I think what we saw last week was that Republicans walked out of the meetings because they said, as Mar said, that Democrats were insisting on tax hikes as a part of that package. So Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Senator John Kyle, a Texas Republican, walked out. And I think that really puts these talks and this issue sort of squarely in the lap of the president right now and House Speaker Boehner. So I think we'll hear more today about how the president will move forward on this. That's what we're looking for.
John, we hear about this August 2nd deadline that Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has said if the ceiling is not raised by August 2nd, the United States will be in default. This has never happened in U.S. history. Republicans say that August 2nd date is arbitrary. It's a Geithner deadline. It's not real. What would happen after August 2nd if this issue isn't resolved?
Well, what the Treasury Secretary says is that he would be unable to juggle the accounts. Right now, he's juggling different accounts, trying to make all the payments that are required by bondholders, Social Security recipients, etc. He says he's going to run out of headroom to juggle those accounts by August 2nd, and that we would risk defaulting on some of our debt. That would mean some bondholder doesn't get an interest payment, some bondholder doesn't get a bond redeemed, and that could create a great deal of chaos in the financial markets. In fact, the IMF urged lawmakers today to raise the nation's borrowing limit because they said inaction could hurt the U.S. economy and global financial markets.
Mara, the president himself got involved in those debt ceiling talks earlier this week. He had essentially outsourced that role to his vice president for some
time. I don't know about outsourcing. I mean, the Republicans say he's not leading, he's not involved. When you send the vice president who speaks for you to lay the groundwork for a deal, I think that's perfectly normal and within bounds. It was always understood that at some point the negotiators, Joe Biden and the congressional leaders, would reach the limits of what they could agree to because the issues were just too hard. And at that moment, government, it would be kicked upstairs to John Boehner and President Obama and Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid, which is what the last negotiations for funding the government through this year did. Remember, Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell kind of worked it out, but then Obama and Boehner had to close the deal. That's what's happening here. It happened a little sooner than people thought, and we didn't think Cantor would walk out in a dramatic huff about it. But we always knew it would get here. We were a little surprised it got here so soon. But these are very tough issues, and both sides have tremendous constraints on them, or both people have, Boehner and Obama, both leaders have constraints on them because of what their respective bases will agree to.
Do you suspect, Mara, that the president, and you touched on this a moment ago, that he's holding this news conference now precisely because he wants to get his message out to the American public?
That's what I think.
I mean, in other words, these negotiations, we have to assume, are not going well.
Well, they're very, very difficult, and the consequences of not coming to a successful agreement that would allow the debt ceiling to be raised would almost certainly end up causing economic damage to the United States. It would hurt the recovery, because if interest rates go up, which is what creditors would do if they believe that our full faith and credit is no longer good, it would raise interest rates, and it would make it harder to reduce the deficit because we'd be paying more for our debt. So there are tremendous economic consequences. Now, the question of who would be blamed if that happened is a big question, and so far it seems like Republicans don't think it would be them. In other words, anything bad about the economy hurts the incumbent, the president, more than it hurts them.
Is there consensus, both for you and Mara, is there, Mara, for you and John, is there consensus among Democrats and Republicans that they ought to resolve this issue now for the long term rather than just a stopgap resolution and then go back and deal with it next year?
When you say stopgap, they're only talking about passing something that would raise the debt ceiling for the next two years. Oh, you're talking about taking smaller chunks than 2 years?
I'm talking about
the big grand bargain.
Right,
No. We are not talking about the big deal here. We are only talking about something to get us through the next 2 years. We're talking about $2 trillion in deficit reduction. No, the big, huge deal that would involve tax reform, lowering rates, broadening the base, getting rid of tax exemptions, real Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security reform, the real big deficit deal, the kind of thing that was sketched out by the President's Deficit Reduction Commission, Erskine Bowles
Indeed,
and Alan Simpson. No, that is not going to happen till after 2012, till after the next election.
It's worth remembering that you don't need to have any kind of deal at all to raise the debt ceiling. Well, we've done it many times in the past.
Except for that Republicans won't vote for it.
That's what they're saying now, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's not required.
No, of course not.
Raise the debt ceiling.
Of course not. But the Republicans have been looking for any point of leverage they could to force the president to agree to spending cuts. And this, they had won with the continuing resolution because Democrats failed to pass a budget last year and the appropriations bills. So they had won. They took a little bite out of it, which turned out to be smaller than conservative Republicans and Tea Party people thought it would be. And that is what's making these negotiations harder, because a lot of conservatives thought they got taken in the last negotiations, so they're putting even more pressure on their leaders this time.
The other thing, I think, Guy, is that Republicans believe, some of them believe, that you could actually default for a short period of time, and it would be fine.
That
you could pay bondholders, that the credit markets wouldn't get upset.
You just would hold some Social Security checks, and that would be okay.
I think that's a miscalculation. But the other thing is that if you got a real deficit reduction deal out of this after a week of being in default, that it would somehow be better. Mm. Now, I think that's a huge risk.
Oh, well, there are people, budget experts, not just Republicans, who think that there won't be a deal until the negotiators are scared out of their wits by a market reaction.
Right.
The markets are going to have to do something, maybe a little spike in interest rates, to force them to compromise. Because remember, up until now, the markets have been very calm. They don't think there's going to be a default.
And they remain calm.
They remain calm. And as a matter of fact, Bruce Johnston, who's at the Chamber of Commerce, had a great quote where he said, the markets are in on the joke. In other words, they know this is all just a bunch of talk, and that even though the debt ceiling was voted down, there was a symbolic vote in the House of Representatives not long ago, that the markets said ho-hum. But if the markets think that a default is real, or could be real, then I think they will react.
And things can change very quickly.
And indeed, we're entering uncharted territory because it's never happened before.
Exactly.
We don't know what would happen.
No, we don't. It's not happened before. And as I said, some Republicans say the government could go on, pay the bondholders, everything would be all right. I think the consensus among economists is that this is playing with fire. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, has urged them to deal with this, and that, you know, this could really end badly if they're not careful.
And, you know, it's almost impossible for me to game this out politically when you think about, okay, now we're going to pay China. The bondholders are at the top of the list. But sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Social Security recipient, we can't pay you because we're busy paying our Chinese creditors. No, and we have to lay off all sorts of federal workers, and people don't get their military pensions. I mean, that... It's hard to imagine who would get blamed in that situation.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to special live coverage from NPR News here in Washington. I'm Guy Raz. In the studio with John Idsty, our national economics correspondent, and Mara Liasson, our national political correspondent. Also, Rachel Martin, our national security correspondent. We're awaiting President Obama's press conference, his first solo press conference since March, and that's expected to happen sometime in the next 10 minutes, although the president has been... late on these occasions in the past. John, sticking with the economy for a moment, the federal stimulus program is set to end, in just a day or so?
The Fed's latest QE2 stimulus program, right? The Fed's injection of $600 billion into the economy will end on Thursday. Now, it doesn't mean the Fed's going to start to tighten up. It will stop easing. It will stop injecting money into the economy and wait to see how things look, but it will not begin to tighten. On the other hand, most people think that politically, even for the Fed, trying to figure out another way to stimulate the economy or doing a third round of this kind of easing would just be politically unpalatable. So I think both the president and the Fed are stuck in terms of how to stimulate the economy. The administration did come up with one way to do it last week when they opened up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and pushed the price of oil down, hoping that the price of gas at the pump would go down and put some money in people's pockets that they could spend on other things. But there's not much left in the bag of tricks for any policymakers in terms of stimulating the economy because the politics of it just don't work.
Because we have such a big debt. And the thing that's so difficult about this, and it's so hard to make a coherent message on the president's part, somebody explained it to me today. We have a fire in the attic and a flood in the basement. The flood is the deficit. The fire is the unemployment rate and the economy right now. You have to put out the fire. By doing that, you're going to make the flood worse for the moment. You're going to make the deficit bigger.
You're
going to pour water. Then you should invest in a long-term sump pump, like the Erskine Bowles Alan Simpson plan, to get the water out of the basement. But you can't, if you burn your house down, you know, while you're getting the flood out of the basement, it really doesn't do you any good. So the president is trying to say we need short-term stimulus, you know, something to help the economy now, but we need a long-term deficit reduction plan that wouldn't kick in right away because that would be counterproductive. This is really hard, hard stuff to communicate.
Mara, several leading economists last week downgraded their forecasts for the U.S. economy for the rest of the second half of this year, including the Federal Reserve, essentially.
Yeah.
How worried is the White House about this issue going into the campaign season?
Like mucho worried.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what it's about. I mean, the economy is what the election is about. That's what incumbent presidents are judged on. And you're going to, you know, the Republicans are going to ask the question. They ask it every day already. Are you better off than you were? Has he fixed the economy? And this is very, very hard. I feel like we are going through almost the exact same thing we went through in the first 2 years of this presidency. We saw the green shoots of growth. For a while, they think, whoa, we're turning a corner. Things are getting better. But they don't. Every time, Greece pops up with another debt crisis, and the unemployment rate spikes again, and things don't look too good. And the fact is that the Fed and these other groups have downgraded their outlook for the next year or two. It's not like they think, oh, this is just gas prices in Japan, and it's all going to go back to normal in a nice trajectory in a month or two. They don't.
The IMF did just that today. They reduced their forecast for U.S. growth. And what we're talking about, in the first half of the year, we've grown under 2%. Going forward, maybe if we're lucky, 2.5 to 3% for the year.
Not enough.
The problem is that these are, even though they're growth rates, they're not enough to bring down unemployment. And that's the key for the White
House. That's the key. It is going to be so hard. I mean, what President Obama wants to do as he runs for re-election is to say we're on the right path, just like Ronald Reagan did. Now, what Ronald Reagan had was tremendously high unemployment. It was over 10%. It came down to about 7.7 by the time he stood for election. But it was coming down rapidly, and he had tremendous growth coming out of that recession. Generally, a financial crisis recession, which is the kind we have now, that doesn't happen. It's much slower, halting, takes a long time to get going. The president has a very, very tough hand to play next year.
Mara Liasson, stand by. John Itzy, stand by. I want to turn to national security and foreign policy for a moment. I'm going to bring in Rachel Martin, our national security correspondent. At least two major foreign policy issues are likely to come up: Afghanistan and the now 4-month-old NATO campaign in Libya, a campaign that was initially billed as something that was going to be over quickly. Both of these conflicts are unpopular and increasingly, at least appearing to be, a political liability for
and expensive,
president.
By the way. We talk about the economy, and this is the trigger for this press conference. All of a sudden, these wars, and you can debate whether or not Libya is a war, which is what I'm sure we'll hear from the president today, defending his decision that this is not a war, but these all of a sudden have a very strong economic component. $10 billion a month being spent on Afghanistan and Iraq collectively, 6.2 in Afghanistan alone. There are governors out there, there are mayors of major cities saying it is very difficult to look at my constituents who are struggling economically and justify what we are spending abroad on these wars. And this is the first time the president is coming out since announcing the troop drawdown. He is likely to get many questions about whether or not that is too much, too little,
right,
and defend his overall strategy.
He's faced complaints that it is too much, too soon, and then some are saying it's not nearly enough.
Yeah, and so, you know, the president has gone down the middle road here, essentially. He didn't leave as many troops there as the military had wanted. They said they needed two full fighting seasons, and they're very intent on moving more troops up towards the east along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. They say they need all those surge troops in place through next calendar year. The president has decided to withdraw those troops at the end of the summer. The military says that's too soon.
He can also expect some tough questions, we imagine, on Libya, specifically the War Powers Act and the administration's interpretation of what constitutes a war.
This is very interesting. We are not in war. We are not at a war in Libya,
according to
the White House. And it comes down to the War Powers Act and a word called hostilities. This is a very subjective term. The War Powers Act says the president is allowed to make a unilateral decision to engage U.S. forces without permission from Congress, but then 60 days later he has to go back and seek that approval. The administration is arguing that this just doesn't apply because the War Powers Act is talking about hostilities. They say that what's happening in Libya doesn't rise to that, to meet that definition. And they point to several reasons for that. There are no U.S. ground troops in Libya. They say there's not a chance of real escalation in that conflict. And they say there's been no, you know, significant threat to American forces, no real American casualties. At the same time, the U.S. has flown more than 700, close to 800 now, attack missions in Libya. And that has raised the ire of people on Capitol Hill who point to this and say, how can you say this with a straight face, that the U.S. is not engaged in war?
In other words, when was the last time that airstrikes did not constitute an act of war?
Exactly. And it's increasingly expensive. The U.S. is spending, you know, tens of millions of dollars, if not in their own direct military activities, then in funding the military operations of NATO allies.
Mara Liasson, do you get the sense that the White House was surprised or maybe taken aback a little bit by the growing Republican opposition to this campaign in Libya, and even some more vocal Republicans expressing concern over Afghanistan?
Yes, I do. I think that something is happening in the oops,
Mara, let me just interrupt. Here's President Obama.
About the economy before I take your questions. There are a lot of folks out there who are still struggling with the effects of the recession. Many people are still looking for work or looking for a job that pays more. Families are wondering how they deal with a broken refrigerator or a busted transmission, or how they're going to finance their kids' college education, and they're also worrying about the possibility of layoffs. The struggles of middle-class families were a big problem before the recession hit in 2007. They weren't created overnight, and the truth is our economic challenges are not going to be solved overnight. But there are more steps that we can take right now that would help businesses create jobs here in America. Today, our administration is trying to take those steps. So we're reviewing government regulations so that we can fix any rules in place that are an unnecessary burden on businesses. We're working with the private sector to get small businesses and startups the financing they need to grow and expand. And because of the partnership that we've launched with businesses and community colleges, 500,000 workers will be able to receive the right skills and training for manufacturing jobs in companies all across America, jobs that companies are looking to fill. In addition to the steps that my administration can take on our own, there are also things that Congress could do right now that will help create good jobs. Right now, Congress can send me a bill that would make it easier for entrepreneurs to patent a new product or idea, because we can't give innovators in other countries a big leg up when it comes to opening new businesses and creating new jobs. That's something Congress could do right now. Right now, Congress could send me a bill that puts construction workers back on the job rebuilding roads and bridges. Not by having government fund and pick every project, but by providing loans to private companies and states and local governments on the basis of merit and not politics. That's pending in Congress right now. Right now, Congress can advance a set of trade agreements that would allow American businesses to sell more of their goods and services to countries in Asia and South America, agreements that would support tens of thousands of American jobs while helping those adversely affected by trade. That's pending before Congress right now. And right now, we could give middle-class families the security of knowing that the tax cut I signed in December will be there for one more year. So there are a number of steps that my administration is taking, but there are also a number of steps that Congress could be taking right now on items that historically have had bipartisan support and that would help put more Americans back to work. Many of these ideas have been tied up in Congress for some time, but as I said, all of them enjoy bipartisan support, and all of them could help grow the economy. So I urge Congress to act on these ideas now. Of course, one of the most important and urgent things we can do for the economy is something that both parties are working on right now, and that's reducing our nation's deficit. Over the last few weeks, the Vice President has been leading negotiations with Democrats and Republicans on this issue, and they've made some real progress in narrowing down the differences. As of last week, both parties had identified more than $1 trillion worth of spending cuts already. But everyone also knows that we'll need to do more to close the deficit. We can't get to the $4 trillion in savings that we need by just cutting the 12% of the budget that pays for things like medical research and education funding and food inspectors and the weather service. And we can't just do it by making seniors pay more for Medicare. So we're going to need to look at the whole budget, as I said several months ago. And we've got to eliminate waste wherever we find it and make some tough decisions about worthy priorities. And that means trimming the defense budget while still meeting our security needs. It means we'll have to tackle entitlements as long as we keep faith with seniors and children with disabilities by maintaining the fundamental security that Medicare and Medicaid provide. And yes, we're going to have to tackle spending in the tax code. There's been a lot of discussion about revenues and raising taxes in recent weeks. So I want to be clear about what we're proposing here. I spent the last 2 years cutting taxes for ordinary Americans. And I want to extend those middle-class tax cuts. The tax cuts I'm proposing we get rid of are tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, tax breaks for oil companies and hedge fund managers and corporate jet owners. It would be nice if we could keep every tax break there is. But we've got to make some tough choices here if we want to reduce our deficit. And if we choose to keep those tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, if we choose to keep a tax break for corporate jet owners, if we choose to keep tax breaks for oil and gas companies that are making hundreds of billions of dollars, then that means we've got to cut some kids off from getting a college scholarship. That means we've got to stop funding certain grants for medical research. That means that food safety may be compromised. That means that Medicare has to bear a greater part of the burden. Those are the choices we have to make. So the bottom line is this. Any agreement to reduce our deficit is going to require tough decisions and balanced solutions. And before we ask our seniors to pay more for health care, before we cut our children's education, before we sacrifice our commitment to the research and innovation that will help create more jobs in the economy, I think it's only fair to ask an oil company or a corporate jet owner that has done so well to give up that tax break that no other business enjoys. I don't think that's real radical. I think the majority of Americans agree with that. So the good news is, because of the work that's been done, I think we can actually bridge our differences. I think there's a conceptual framework that would allow us to make huge progress on our debt and deficit and do so in a way that does not hurt our economy right here and right now. And it's not often that Washington sees both parties agree on the scale and the urgency of the challenge at hand. Nobody wants to put the creditworthiness of the United States in jeopardy. Nobody wants to see the United States default. So we've got to seize this moment, and we have to seize it soon. The Vice President and I will continue these negotiations with both leaders of both parties in Congress for as long as it takes. And we will reach a deal that will require our government to live within its means and give our businesses confidence and get this economy moving. So with that, I will take your questions. I've got my list here, starting off with Ben Feller, Associated Press.
You're listening to the special live coverage from NPR News. It's President Obama at the White House taking questions from reporters.
You just made as you try to reach a deal to raise the debt limit and cut the deficit. You keep saying that there needs to be this balanced approach of spending cuts and taxes, but Republicans say flatly they won't.
That they don't want a balanced approach.
They don't want any. They don't want any tax increases, as they put it. And the House Speaker says not only that he doesn't support that, but that plan will not pass the House. So my question is, will you insist ultimately that a deal has to include those tax increases that you just laid out? Is that an absolute red line for you? And if it is, can you explain to us how that can possibly get through the Congress?
Look, I think that what we've seen in negotiations here in Washington is a lot of people say a lot of things to satisfy their base or to get on cable news, but that hopefully leaders at a certain point rise to the occasion and they do the right thing for the American people. And that's what I expect to happen this time. Call me naive, but my expectation is that leaders are going to lead. Now, I just want to be clear about what's at stake here. The Republicans say they want to reduce the deficit. Every single observer who's not an elected official, who's not a politician, says we can't reduce our deficit in the scale and scope that we need to without having a balanced approach that looks at everything. Democrats have to accept some painful spending cuts that hurt some of our constituencies and we may not like. And we've shown a willingness to do that for the greater good. To say, look, there's some things that are good programs, they're nice to have, we can't afford them right now. I, as Commander-in-Chief, have to have difficult conversations with the Pentagon saying, you know what, there's fat here, we're going to have to trim it out. And Bob Gates has already done a good job identifying $400 billion in cuts, but we're going to do more. And I promise you, the preference of the Pentagon would be not to cut anymore because they feel like they've already given. So we're going to have to look at entitlements. And that's always difficult politically. But I've been willing to say we need to see where we can reduce the cost of health care spending and Medicare and Medicaid in the out years not by shifting costs onto seniors, as some have proposed, but rather by actually reducing those costs. But even if we're doing it in a smart way, that's still tough politics, but it's the right thing to do. So the question is, if everybody else is willing to take on their sacred cows and do tough things in order to achieve the goal of real deficit reduction, then I think it would be hard for the Republicans to stand there and say that the tax break for corporate jets is sufficiently important that we're not willing to come to the table and get a deal done. Or we're so concerned about protecting oil and gas subsidies for oil companies that are making money hand over fist, that's the reason we're not going to come to a deal. I don't think that's a sustainable position. And the truth of the matter is, if you talk to Republicans who are not currently in office, like Alan Simpson, who co-chaired my bipartisan commission, he doesn't think that's a sustainable position. Pete Domenici, Republican, co-chaired something with Alice Rivlin, the Democrat, says that he doesn't think that's a sustainable position. You can't reduce the deficit to the levels that it needs to be reduced without having some revenue in the mix. And the revenue we're talking about isn't coming out of the pockets of middle-class families that are struggling. It's coming out of folks who are doing extraordinarily well and are enjoying the lowest tax rates since before I was born. If you are a wealthy CEO or health hedge fund manager in America right now, your taxes are lower than they have ever been. They're lower than they've been since the 1950s. And you can afford it. You'll still be able to ride on your corporate jet. You're just going to have to pay a little more. And if we, I just want to emphasize what I said earlier. If we do not have revenues, that means there are a bunch of kids out there who are not getting college scholarships. If we do not have those revenues, then the kinds of cuts that would be required might compromise the National Weather Service. It means that we would not be funding critical medical research. It means that food inspection might be compromised. And I've said to some of the Republican leaders, you go talk to your constituents, the Republican constituents, and ask them, are they willing to compromise their kids' safety so that some corporate jet owner continues to get a tax break? And I'm pretty sure what the answer would be. So we're going to keep on having these conversations. And my belief is that the Republican leadership in Congress will hopefully sooner rather than later come to the conclusion that they need to make the right decisions for the country, that everybody else has been willing to move off their maximalist position. They need to do the same.
Do you think they will get done?
My expectation is that they'll do the responsible thing. Chuck Todd.
Thank you, Mr. President. There have been a lot of questions about the constitutional interpretations of a few decisions you've made. So I just simply ask, do you believe the War Powers Act is constitutional? Do you believe that the debt limit is constitutional, the idea that Congress can do this? And do you believe that marriage is a civil right?
Well, that was a hodgepodge. We're going to assign you to the Supreme Court, man. I'm not a Supreme Court justice, so I'm not going to put my constitutional law professor hat on here. Let me focus on initially the issue of Libya. I want to talk about the substance of Libya, because there's been all kinds of noise about process and congressional consultation and so forth. Let's talk about concretely what's happened. Muammar Gaddafi, who prior to Osama bin Laden was responsible for more American deaths than just about anybody on the planet, was threatening to massacre his people. And as part of an international coalition under a UN mandate that is almost unprecedented, we went in and took out air defense systems so that an international coalition could provide a no-fly zone, could protect, provide humanitarian protection to the people on the ground. I spoke to the American people about what we would do. I said there would be no troops on the ground. I said that we would not be carrying the lion's share of this operation, but as members of NATO, we would be supportive of it because it's in our national security interests and also because it's the right thing to do. We have done exactly what I said we would do. We have not put any boots on the ground, and our allies, who historically we've complained aren't willing to carry enough of the load when it comes to NATO operations, have carried a big load when it comes to these NATO operations. And as a consequence, we've protected thousands of people in Libya. We have not seen a single U.S. casualty. There's no risks of additional escalation. This operation is limited in time and in scope. So I said to the American people, here's our narrow mission. We have carried out that narrow mission in exemplary fashion. And throughout this process, we consulted with Congress. We've had 10 hearings on it. We've sent reams of information about what the operations are. I've had all the members of Congress over to talk about it. So a lot of this fuss is politics. And if you look substantively at what we've done, we have done exactly what we said to do under a UN mandate, and we have protected thousands of lives in the process. And as a consequence, a guy who was a state sponsor of terrorist operations against the United States of America is pinned down, and the noose is tightening around him. Now, when you look at the history of the War Powers Resolution, it came up after the Vietnam War, in which we had 500,000 soldiers there, tens of thousands of lives lost, hundreds of billions of dollars spent. And Congress said, you know what, we don't want something like that happening again. So if you're going to start getting us into those kinds of commitments, you've got to consult with Congress beforehand. And I think that such consultation is entirely appropriate. But do I think that our actions in any way violate the War Powers Resolution? The answer is no. So I don't even have to get to the constitutional question. There may be a time in which there was a serious question as to whether or not the War Powers Resolution Act was constitutional. I don't have to get to the question. We have engaged in a limited operation to help a lot of people against one of the worst tyrants in the world. Somebody who nobody should want to defend. And we should be sending out a unified message to this guy that he should step down and give his people a fair chance to live their lives without fear. And this suddenly becomes the cause célèbre for some folks in Congress? Come on. So you had what, a three-parter? What are the other two?
There is a question about the constitutionality.
I'm just saying I don't have to reach it. That's a good legal answer. Let me start by saying that this administration, under my direction, has consistently said we cannot discriminate as a country against people on the basis of sexual orientation. And we have done more in the 2.5 years that I've been in here than the previous 43 presidents to uphold that principle, whether it's ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, making sure that gay and lesbian partners can visit each other in hospitals, that not only is the government not going to default, but we're also preparing for a future in which the population is getting older, and we're going to have more expenses on the Medicare side and Social Security, that business will feel more confident about investing here in the United States of America. So I don't think they're contradictory. And as I've said before, certainly in my job, but I think Congress as well, they've got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So we can focus on jobs at the same time as we're focusing on debt and deficit reduction. Now, one of the things that my administration has talked about is there, in fact, a tangle of regulations out there that are preventing businesses from growing and expanding as quickly as they should? Keep in mind that the business community is always complaining about regulations. When unemployment's at 3% and they're making record profits, they're going to still complain about regulations because, frankly, they want to be able to do whatever they think is going to maximize their profits. I've got an obligation to make sure that we're upholding smart regulations that protect our air and protect our water and protect our food. If you're flying on a plane, you want to make sure that there are some regulations in place to assure safety in air travel, right? So there's some core regulations that we've got to maintain. But what I have done, and this is unprecedented, by the way, no administration has done this before, is I've said to each agency, don't just look at current regulations, or don't just look at future regulations, regulations that we're proposing. Let's go backwards and look at regulations that are already in the books, and if they don't make sense, let's get rid of them. And we are in the process of doing that, and we've already identified changes that could potentially save billions of dollars for companies over the next several years. Now, you asked specifically about decision that was made by the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. And this relates to Boeing. Essentially, the NLRB made a finding that Boeing had not followed the law in making a decision to move a plant. It's an independent agency. It's going before a judge. So I don't want to get into the details of the case. I don't know all the facts. That's going to be up to a judge to decide. What I do know is this, that as a general proposition, companies need to have the freedom to relocate. They have to follow the law, but that's part of our system. And if they're choosing to relocate here in the United States, that's a good thing. And what it doesn't make, what I think defies common sense, would be a notion that we would be shutting down a plant or laying off workers because labor and management can't come to a sensible agreement. So my hope is that even as this thing is working its way through, everybody steps back for a second and says, look, If jobs are being created here in the United States, let's make sure that we're encouraging that. And we can't afford to have labor and management fighting all the time at a time when we're competing against Germany and China and other countries that want to sell goods all around the world. And obviously, the airplane industry is an area where we still have a huge advantage. I want to make sure that we keep it. Okay. Mark Landon.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Yesterday, Admiral McRaven testified before Congress that he was concerned that there wasn't a clear procedure to be followed if a terrorist were captured alive abroad. The administration has also been clear that it doesn't want to continue to send suspected terrorists to Guantanamo. What message do you have for American men and women in uniform who are undertaking missions like the very risky one to capture and kill bin Laden, about what they should do in the event that they capture someone alive? And does the lack of these clear procedures raise the risk that forces might be more inclined to kill suspected terrorists in the field rather than capture them alive, thus depriving the U.S. of the intelligence that they could provide?
Well, First of all, my top priority in each and every one of these situations is to make sure that we're apprehending those who would attack the United States, that we are getting all the intelligence that we can out of these individuals in a way that's consistent with due process of law, that we try them, we prosecute them in a way that's consistent with rule of law. And frankly, there are going to be different dispositions of the case depending on the situation. I mean, there are going to be some times where a military commission may be appropriate. There are going to be some times where Article III courts are appropriate in terms of prosecution. And we do have a process to work through all the agencies, Department of Defense, Department of Justice, FBI, anybody else who might be involved in these kinds of operations, to think through on a case-by-case basis how a particular individual should be dealt with. And I think that when it comes to our men and women in uniform who might be carrying out these missions, the instructions are not going to be based on whether or not the lawyers can sort out how we detain them or how we prosecute them. Their mission is to make sure that they apprehend the individual, they do so safely, with minimum risk to American lives. And that's always going to be the priority, is just carrying out the mission. And that message is sent consistently to our men and women in uniform anytime they start carrying out one of these missions. But I think it's important to understand, and the American people need to be assured, that any time we initiate a mission like this, our top priorities are making sure this person is not able to carry out attacks against the United States, and that we're able to obtain actionable intelligence from those individuals. And so that mitigates against this danger that you're suggesting, that our main goal is going to be to kill these individuals as opposed to potentially capturing them. Okay. Mike Emanuel, Fox.
Thank you, Mr. President. Last week when you gave your Afghanistan drawdown speech, the word victory in terms of the overall war in Afghanistan was not in your speech. So I'm wondering, sir, if you can define for the 100,000 troops you have in harm's way in Afghanistan, victory in the war, and for their families as well, sir.
Well, yeah, I didn't use victory in my West Point speech either. What I said was we can be successful in our mission, which is narrowly drawn, and that is to make sure that al-Qaeda cannot attack the United States of America or our allies or our interests overseas, and to make sure that we have an Afghan government that and an Afghan people that can provide for their own security. We are being successful in those missions. And the reason that we're in a position to draw down 10,000 troops this year and a total of 33,000 troops by the end of next summer is precisely because of the extraordinary work of our men and women in uniform. What they've been able to do is to severely cripple al-Qaeda's capacities. Obviously, bin Laden got the most attention, but even before the bin Laden operation, we had decimated the middle ranks and some of the upper ranks of al-Qaeda. They're having a great deal of difficulty operating, a great deal of difficulty communicating and financing themselves, and we are going to keep the pressure on. And in part, that's because of the extraordinary sacrifices that have been made by our men and women in uniform in Afghanistan. What we've also been able to do is to ramp up the training of Afghan forces. So we've got an additional 100,000 Afghan troops, both Army and police, that have been trained as a consequence of this surge. And that is going to give the Afghans more capacity to defend themselves, because it is in our national interest to make sure that you did not have a collapse of Afghanistan in which extremist elements could flood the zone once again, and over time, al-Qaeda might be in a position to rebuild itself. So what I laid out was a plan in which we are going to be drawing down our troops from Afghanistan after 10 very long years and enormous sacrifice by our troops, but we will draw them in a draw them down in a responsible way that will allow Afghanistan to defend itself and will give us the operational capacity to continue to put pressure on al-Qaeda until that network is entirely defeated. Well, keep in mind, the drawdown hasn't begun, so we understood that Afghanistan's a dangerous place, that the Taliban is still active, and that there's still going to be events like this on occasion. The question is, in terms of overall trend, is Afghan capacity increasing? Kabul, for example, which contains a huge proportion of the Afghan population as a whole, has been largely policed by Afghan forces for quite some time, and they've done a reasonably good job. Kabul is much safer than it was, and Afghan forces in Kabul are much more capable than they were. That doesn't mean that there are not going to be events like this potentially taking place, and that will probably go on for some time. Our work is not done. But as I said in my speech, the tide of war is receding. We have shifted to a transition phase, and much like we've seen in Iraq, where we have drawn down our troops, the remainder of our troops will be coming out by the end of this year, but Iraq has been able to maintain a democratic government and to tamp down violence there. We think a similar approach makes sense in Afghanistan. But even in Iraq, you still see the occasional attack. These are still countries that are digging themselves out of a lot of war, a lot of conflict. They're dangerous places, and so they're not going to be perfectly safe, even if we were there, but we can improve the chances for the Afghan people to defend themselves. Jim Sciutto.
Thank you, Mr. President. You're aware that Senators Kerry and McCain have a proposal on the Senate floor to give you the leeway to continue operations in Libya for a further year. You've just said that this, from the beginning, has been an operation limited in time and scope. Initially, you said days, not weeks. Are you prepared, are the American people prepared for this operation with American support to continue for a further year? And is there any other definition of success than Gaddafi being removed from power?
Well, first of all, Jim, just a slight correction. What I told the American people was that the initial phase where Americans were in the lead would take days, if perhaps weeks. And that's exactly what happened, right? I mean, after around 2 weeks, a little less than 2 weeks, we had transitioned where NATO had taken full control of the operation. So promise made, promise kept. Second, I think when you have the former Republican nominee for president, John McCain, and the former nominee for president on the Democratic side, John Kerry, coming together to support what we're doing in Libya, that should tell the American people that this is important. And I very much appreciate their efforts in that regard. Third, when it comes to our definitions of success, The UN mandate has said that we are there to make sure that you do not see a massacre directed against Libyan civilians by the Libyan regime. The Libyan regime's capacity has been greatly reduced as a consequence of our operation. That's already been successful. What we've seen both in the East and in the West is that opposition forces have been able to mobilize themselves and start getting organized, and people are starting to see the possibility of a more peaceful future on the horizon. What is also true is, as long as Gaddafi is still presenting himself as the head of the Libyan government, and as long as he still controls large numbers of troops, the Libyan people are going to be in danger of counteroffensives and of retribution. So there is no doubt that Gaddafi stepping down from power is from the international community's perspective, going to be the primary way that we can assure that the overall mission of Libya's people being protected is accomplished. And I just want to point out, I know something you know, the International Criminal Court identified Gaddafi as having violated international law, having committed war crimes. What we've seen is reports of troops engaging in horrible acts, including potentially using rape as a weapon of war. And so when you have somebody like that in charge of large numbers of troops, I think it'd be hard for us to feel confident that the Libyan people are going to be protected unless he steps down. Now, what that means, whether there's the possibility of Libyans arriving at some sort of political settlement, you know, that, I think, is something that ultimately the Libyan people are going to have to make a decision about, you know, because the international community is there in service of that broader goal of a peaceful Libya.
Would you accept a political settlement with him involved as success from the American perspective?
I would accept him stepping down so that he is not directing armed forces against the Libyan people. He needs to step down. He needs to go. Laura Meckler.
Thank you, Mr. President. In these debt talks, would you accept? Would you like to see some sort of tax breaks aimed at stimulating the economy, even though that would, of course, add to the deficit itself? And I'd also like to follow up on one of your earlier answers about same-sex marriage. You said that it's a positive step that so many states, including New York, are moving towards that. Does that mean that you personally now do support same-sex marriage, putting aside what individual states decide? Is that your personal view?
I'm not going to make news on that today. Good try, though. And the with respect to the deficit and debt talks and where we need to go, I do think it's important, since we're looking at how do we reduce the debt and deficit both in a 10-year window as well as beyond a 10-year window, to understand that one of the most important things we can do for debt and deficit reduction is to grow the economy. And so if there are steps that in the short term may reduce the amount of cash in the Treasury, but in the long term mean that we're growing at 3.5% instead of 2.5%, then those ideas are worth exploring. Obviously, that was what we did in December during the lame duck session, when Democrats and Republicans came together and we said, you know what, a payroll tax cut makes sense in order to boost the economy. Unemployment insurance makes sense in order to boost the economy. All that stuff puts money in people's pockets at a time when they're still struggling to dig themselves out of this recession. And so the American people have an extra $1,000 on average in their pockets because of the tax cuts that we initiated. And that has helped cushion some of the tough stuff that happened in the first 6 months of this year, including the effects on oil prices as a consequence of what happened in the Middle East, as well as what happened in Japan. I think that it makes perfect sense for us to take a look at, can we extend the payroll tax, for example, an additional year, and other tax breaks for business investment that could make a big difference in terms of creating more jobs right now. What we need to do is to restore business confidence and the confidence of the American people that we're on track, that we're not going to get there right away, that this is a tough slog, but that we still are moving forward. And I think that it makes sense, as we're looking at an overall package, to see, are there some things that we can do to sustain the recovery, so long as the overall package achieves our goals, the goals that I set out, which is $4 trillion within a 10 to 12-year window, and making sure that we're bending the costs of things like health care over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
Laura, I think this has been asked and answered. I'll keep on giving you the same answer until I give you a different one. All right? And that won't be today. Yeah, exactly. I thought you'd like that one. Antonietta Cadiz? There you are.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Yeah. First, if you receive a mandatory E-Verify bill only without legalization, are you planning to veto that bill? And second, on Fast and Furious, members of Congress and the government of Mexico are still waiting for answers. Are you planning to replace ATF leadership, and when can we expect the results of the current investigation?
On the second question, as you know, my Attorney General has made clear that he certainly would not have ordered gun running to be able to pass through into Mexico. The investigation is still pending. I'm not going to comment on a current investigation. I've made very clear my views that that would not be an appropriate step by the ATF, and we've got to find out how that happened. As soon as the investigation is completed, I think appropriate actions will be taken. With respect to E-Verify, we need comprehensive immigration reform. I've said it before. I will say it again. I will say it next week, and I'll say it 6 months from now. We've got to have a system that makes sure that we uphold our tradition as a nation of laws, and that we also uphold our tradition as a nation of immigrants. And that means tough border security, going after employers that are illegally hiring and exploiting workers, making sure that we also have a pathway for legal status for those who are living in the shadows right now. We may not be able to get everything that I would like to see in a package, but we have to have a balanced package. E-Verify can be an important enforcement tool if it's not riddled with errors, if U.S. citizens are protected, because what I don't want is a situation in which employers are forced to set up a system that they can't be certain works. And we don't want to expose employers to the risk where they end up rejecting a qualified candidate for a job because the list says that that person's an illegal immigrant, and it turns out that the person isn't an illegal immigrant. That wouldn't be fair for the employee and would probably get the employer in trouble as well. So I think the goal right now is to let's continue to see if we can perfect the E-Verify system. Let's make sure that we have safeguards in place to prevent the kind of scenarios that I talked about. But let's also not lose sight of some of the other components to immigration reform. For example, making sure that DREAM Act kids who have grown up here in the United States, think of themselves as Americans, who are not legal through no fault of their own, and who are ready to invest and give back to our country and go to school and fight in our military and start businesses here, let's make sure that those kids can stay. We need to have a more balanced approach than just a verification system. Okay? I don't have an answer as to whether the investigation is completed yet, and it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on the investigation if it's not yet completed. Okay. Jessica Yellen, congratulations. Your first question here.
Thank you, Mr.
No pressure.
President.
You're going to do great.
Yeah, thank you. Your administration has laid out four different dates by which you said that the debt ceiling must be raised or the U.S. would face potential dire consequences. Three of those dates have come and gone, and we haven't faced financial calamity. Some of your critics have argued that these are then scare tactics to force a deal. So why should the American people believe that the August 2nd deadline is the final deadline by which a deal must be raised? And would you also spell out for us what you believe will happen if the debt ceiling is not raised by that date?
Jessica, let's be clear. We haven't given out four different dates. We have given out dates that are markers for us getting into trouble. It's the equivalent of you're driving down the street and the yellow light starts flashing. The yellow light is flashing. Now, it hasn't been a red light yet. So what Tim Geithner has said is, technically speaking, you know, we're in a position now where we're having to do a whole bunch of things to make sure that our bills are paid. By August 2nd, we run out of tools to make sure that all our bills are paid. So that is a hard deadline. And I want everybody to understand that this is a jobs issue. This is not an abstraction. If the United States government, for the first time, cannot pay its bills, if it defaults, then the consequences for the U.S. economy will be significant and unpredictable, and that is not a good thing. We don't know how capital markets will react. But if capital markets suddenly decide, you know what, the U.S. government doesn't pay its bills, so we're going to start pulling our money out, and the U.S. Treasury has to start to raise interest rates in order to attract more money to pay off our bills, that means higher interest rates for businesses. That means higher interest rates for consumers. So all the headwinds that we're already experiencing in terms of the recovery will get worse. That's not my opinion. I think that's a consensus opinion. And that means that job growth will be further stymied. It will be further hampered as a consequence of that decision. So that's point number one. Point number two, I want to address what I've been hearing from some quarters, which is, well, maybe this debt limit thing is not really that serious. We can just pay interest on the debt. This idea has been floating around in some Republican circles. This is the equivalent of me saying, you know what, I will choose to pay my mortgage, but I'm not going to pay my car note. Or I'm going to pay my car note, but I'm not going to pay my student loan. Now, a lot of people in really tough situations are having to make those tough decisions. But for the U.S. government to start picking and choosing like that is not going to inspire a lot of confidence. Moreover, which bills are we going to decide to pay? These guys have said, well, maybe we just pay the interest on for bondholders. So are we really going to start paying interest to Chinese who hold treasuries, and we're not going to pay folks their Social Security checks? Or we're not going to pay to veterans for their disability checks? I mean, which bills, which obligations are we going to say we don't have to pay? And last point I want to make about this. These are bills that Congress ran up. The money has been spent. The obligations have been made. So this isn't a situation, I think the American people have to understand this. This is not a situation where you know, Congress is going to say, okay, we won't buy this car or we won't take this vacation. They took the vacation, they bought the car, and now they're saying maybe we don't have to pay, or we don't have to pay as fast as we said we were going to, or that's not how responsible families act. And we're the greatest nation on earth, and we can't act that way. So this is urgent. And it needs to get settled.
Yeah. So is August 2nd a yellow light or a red light?
I think people should think of, look, I'm the President of the United States, and I want to make sure that I am not engaging in scare tactics. And I've tried to be responsible and somewhat restrained so that folks don't get spooked. August 2nd is a very important date. And there's no reason why we can't get this done now. We know what the options are out there. This is not a technical problem any longer. This is a matter of Congress going ahead and biting the bullet and making some tough decisions. Because we know what the decisions are. We've identified what spending cuts are possible. We've identified what defense cuts are possible. We've identified what health care cuts are possible. We've identified what loopholes in the tax code can be closed that would also raise revenue. We've identified what the options are. And the question now is, are we going to step up and get this done? And, you know, Malia and Sasha generally finish their homework a day ahead of time. Malia's 13, Sasha's 10. It is impressive. They don't wait until the night before. They're not pulling all-nighters. They're 13 and 10. You know, Congress can do the same thing. If you know you've got to do something, just do it. And I've got to say, I'm very amused when I start hearing comments about, well, the president needs to show more leadership on this. Let me tell you something. Right after we finished dealing with the government shutdown, averting a government shutdown, I called the leaders here together. I said, we've got to get this done. I put Vice President Biden in charge of a process that, by the way, has made real progress, but these guys have met, worked through all of the issues. I met with every single caucus for an hour to an hour and a half each. Republican senators, Democratic senators. Republican House, Democratic House. I've met with the leaders multiple times. At a certain point, they need to do their job. You know, and so this thing, which is just not on the level, where we have meetings and discussions and we're working through process, and when they decide they're not happy with the fact that at some point you've got to make a choice, they just all step back and say, well, you know, the president needs to get this done. They need to do their job. Now's the time to go ahead and make the tough choices. That's why they're called leaders. And I've already shown that I'm willing to make some decisions that are very tough and will, you know, give my base of voters further reason to give me a hard time. But it's got to be done. And so there's no point in procrastinating. There's no point in putting it off. We've got to get this done. And if by the end of this week we have not seen substantial progress, then I think members of Congress need to understand we are going to, you know, start having to cancel things and stay here until we get it done. You know, they're in 1 week, they're out 1 week, and then they're saying Obama's got to step in. You need to be here. I've been here. I've been doing Afghanistan and Bin Laden and the Greek crisis, and you stay here. Let's get it done. All right. I think you know my feelings about that. Karen Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. President. You talked about the payroll tax holiday and possibly extending that. Are you worried, though, that by adding a discussion of short-term measures on the economy into these discussions about long-term deficit reductions, that that may complicate the conversation and make it harder to pass a debt limit?
Let me put it this way. If we've got a good deal on debt and deficit reduction that focuses not just on the 10-year window but also the long-term, we will get it done. And then we can argue about some other things, because I think that's very important. I will say that precisely because tough votes in Congress are often avoided, that it may make sense to also deal with something like a payroll tax cut at the same time, because it does have budget implications, and the American people need to know that we're focused on jobs and not just on deficit reduction, even though, as I said, deficit reduction helps to serve the job agenda. I think they want to have some confidence that we got a plan that's helping right now. But I don't think it should be a complicating factor, because if you know, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner came to me and said, all right, we're ready to make a deal. Here's a balanced approach to debt and deficit reduction, but we want to argue about payroll tax cuts later. They're not set to expire until the end of this year. If that was a situation that they presented, then I think, you know, we would have a serious conversation about that. I would not discount that completely. I do think that the steps that I talked about to deal with job growth and economic growth right now are vitally important to deficit reduction. Just as deficit reduction is important to grow the economy and to create jobs, well, creating jobs and growing the economy also helps reduce the deficit. If we just increase the growth rate by one percentage point, that would drastically bring down the long-term projections of the deficit, because people are paying more into the coffers and fewer people are drawing unemployment insurance. And it makes a huge difference. And this may be sort of a good place to wrap up. You know, every day I get letters from folks all around the country who show incredible resilience, incredible determination, but they are having a very, very tough time. They're losing their homes. Some have lost their businesses. Some have lost work and have not been able to find jobs for months, maybe a year, maybe a year and a half. And they feel some desperation. And some folks who are working just are having a tough time paying the bills because they haven't seen their wages or incomes go up in 10 years. And the costs of everything else have gone up. And every day that weighs on me. Every minute of every day that weighs on me. Because I ran for president precisely to make sure that we righted this ship and we start once again creating a situation where middle-class families and people who aspire to be in the middle class, if they're working hard, then they're living a better life. Now, these structural changes in our economy that have been going on for a decade, in some cases longer, they're not going to be solved overnight. But we know what to do. We know that if we are educating our kids well, then they're going to be more competitive. We know that if we are investing in things like infrastructure, it pays off. I was in Alcoa in Iowa, one of our most successful companies. They took a big hit during the recession, but they still invested $90 million in new equipment in a plant that makes airplane wings and parts for automobiles, and they've bounced back. They've hired back all their people and are increasing market share because they made those investments. Well, just like a company like Alcoa, America's got to make some investments. We know that we've got to get control of our deficit. There are some things that aren't going to solve all our problems but can make progress right now. And the question is whether or not Democrats and Republicans are willing to put aside the expedience of short-term politics in order to get it done. And these folks are counting on us. They desperately want to believe that their leadership is thinking about them and not playing games. And I think that if all the leadership here in Washington has the faces and the stories of those families in mind, then we will solve this debt limit issue. We will put in place steps like a payroll tax cut and infrastructure development. We'll continue to fund education. We'll hold true to our commitment to our seniors. These are solvable problems, but it does require us just getting out of the short-term and, frankly, selfish approach that sometimes politics breeds. We've got to think a bit long-term. All right. Thank you very much, everybody.
That's President Obama taking questions from reporters in the East Room at the White House. The president said he was optimistic about a deal on debt and deficit reduction with Republicans. Most of the questions were primarily about the economy, but he did warn that if the U.S. defaults on its loans, the consequences for the economy will be, quote, significant. The president was also asked about Afghanistan, where he said we can be successful, and Libya, where he offered a robust defense of his decision to intervene. And finally, the president touched on the issue of gay marriage, but he stopped short of endorsing gay marriage. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to special coverage from NPR News. And with me in the studio is NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson, NPR's economics correspondent John Isdey, and our national security correspondent Rachel Martin. And Mara, let me begin with you. Obviously, most of the questions were about the economy, about these ongoing budget and deficit talks and debt ceiling talks, rather, with congressional Republicans. Did we learn anything new from the president, or was it essentially offering his position in his defense of where he stands on?
Well, he was offering his position, and that in itself is new because he hasn't really done that extensively yet in these debt ceiling negotiations. A lot of times this White House uses a press conference as an opportunity for the president to get some message across that he doesn't feel that he's been able to do successfully. And then the questions are almost like wallpaper. And I think that's what happened here. I mean, he didn't make a lot of news, but he did explain more clearly and coherently than I've heard him say before what his position is. His position is we have to have a balanced approach to cutting the deficit, and that cutting the deficit is going to help the economy over the long term. At the same time that we do that, we need to do something to help the economy in the short term, even at the cost of adding to the deficit. So he did say that the payroll tax cut that he signed into law in December as a result of negotiations with the Republicans should be extended for another year. He said he's also looking at other things that could help encourage businesses to hire, other kinds of tax cuts. And he said, but it shouldn't be a complicating factor with deficit reduction. You can do deficit reduction at the same time. And he urged the Republicans to make the tough choices between, as he put it, defending the tax write-off for corporate jet owners or cutting scholarship aid for students or food safety workers. So he's saying, I'm willing to make tough choices that will anger my base on things like entitlements and Medicare. You have to do the same thing because nobody can get 100% of what they want.
We did indeed hear a lot about corporate jet owners for the time being, I guess, the new villains in Washington. John Isdey, the president said the yellow light is flashing. He is essentially saying, look, I don't want to be alarmist here, but August 2nd is a pretty significant date.
Right. He said the yellow light is flashing. They're rearranging now from one account to another in order to be able to pay the government's debts during this period. But on August 2nd, they're going to run out of the tools to do that.
Unless congressional Republicans agree to raise the debt ceiling.
Unless congressional Republicans agree to raise the debt ceiling. He sort of stepped back from saying August 2nd was a drop-dead date. Mm-hmm. He said he didn't want to engage in scare tactics. And in fact, we're going to get another report from the Treasury at the end of the week, and we could get a change in that number from one day to another. They report monthly on the debt situation. So it could end up being August 3rd or 4th, or it could move forward to August 1st. So, I think he tried not to engage in scare tactics. Mm-hmm. He didn't say it was drop dead, but he says we've got to get this done.
Mara.
He did frame that question a little bit more sharply. What he said was, to Republicans who think that going into technical default is fine, we could just pay interest to China, for instance, and,
right,
and hold off paying Social Security checks to our seniors. He framed it in that way, that if you want us, if you don't increase the debt limit, we're going to be put in the position of picking and choosing who we're going to pay. And the Republicans, in essence, are saying, let's just pay interest to our creditors, so pay the Chinese, but don't pay Social Security or military pensions. And I think that's the political argument that he's trying to frame.
I think that would be difficult, because you've got to decide who you're going to pay. I mean, that's a big, when you think about the government's debt and arranging a payment to one and not to the other.
Right, that's why he says on August 2nd we run out of tools.
Right.
Now, the other thing he did say that was, he sidled up to making some news. He said, if by the end of this week we don't make progress, we're going to have to cancel things and stay here to get things done. In other words, July 4th recess. What he's saying is, he rarely talks about his daughters, but he did say that Malia and Sasha don't leave their homework till the last minute. They don't pull an all-nighter. Congress shouldn't either. We shouldn't wait till August 2nd or midnight on August 1st. We should get this done this week. And John Boehner had also put July 4th or July 1st as a kind of deadline to do this. You don't want to wait till the last minute to spook the markets. Let's get a debt ceiling deal early. And this week is really it. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see if he really does stand up and said, okay, you can't go home. You have to stay here and negotiate.
And the president, right at the outset of his remarks, said there are steps we can take to create jobs, but essentially saying this Congress is not willing to work with the administration to take those steps. And I wonder...
I think he was addressing something different, though.
He was saying basically there are things we've agreed on that the Congress hasn't even done.
Yes.
And I would suggest that they're relatively minor things that aren't going to create a lot of jobs. But he ticked off about three or four things that could be done by the Congress now, including passing some trade deals.
Right. Which will be passed eventually.
Which will, but he's saying, do your job. And I think this is one thing that the president was trying to make clear also. He's been criticized for not leading on these debt ceiling talks. And he made a case that he has led, and the Congress knows what needs to be done at this point, and they just need to do it.
But there's another thing. When I heard him say there are some things that we're taking right now, like reviewing government regulation, there's some things that Congress can do right now to improve the economy. What I heard him trying to do was answer this criticism and a real worry among Democrats that he doesn't have a jobs plan. He still doesn't have one. And saying all these little things like reviewing government regulations, working with the private sector to get small business financing, and encouraging Congress to pass trade deals, that doesn't add up to a compelling jobs plan. The president still doesn't have a message for people who are hurting. What does he want to do to help them right now? Long-range deficit reduction is part of it, but he needs a jobs plan, and I thought that that's why he was trying to list all of these concrete things to help the economy right now.
One of the things the president also did not talk about was tax increases. He talked about eliminating tax breaks for the wealthy, saying that in order to tackle these big issues, the closing the budget deficit, you got to cut spending, but you're also going to have to eliminate tax breaks for those corporate jet owners. But no talk about specifically increasing taxes.
No, and there won't be. I mean, I think that everybody agrees that if you're going to do tax reform, there's a big consensus on this, and this is the Simpson-Bowles plan, that you lower rates across the board, but in order to do that, you have to get rid of a lot of deductions, tax expenditures, spending through the tax code. Corporate jet owners just happens to be one of the least popular things that he could think of. But if you really want to do this,
and
you're talking about mortgage.
Oil and
gas companies. But if you really are going to do this, real tax reform, you're going to have to talk about the mortgage interest deduction and the employer-provided health deduction. And there's a lot of sacred cows there.
But what the president is trying to do is say, this is spending through the tax code, and by eliminating it, we're not increasing taxes. What Republicans are saying is these are tax increases.
Yes. Republicans say every tax break is sacred and everyone must be defended to the death. Now, not all of Republicans say that. They just voted. I think 33 Republicans voted in the Senate to get rid of the ethanol subsidy. That's a tax break. That's spending through the tax code to people who produce ethanol. So I think that there has been a big tectonic shift on the way that we look at tax breaks, tax loopholes. Conservative economists like Martin Feldstein have been saying that these are spending by another name, spending through the tax code. And they will be on the chopping block when this town finally gets around in 2 years or so to talking about real tax reform.
The grand agreement.
Yes.
Big deal.
Mara Lyson, John Issey, stand by. I want to shift to our national security correspondent, Rachel Martin, and ask Rachel not too many questions about foreign policy, but there were some questions about Afghanistan, about Libya. The president offered a robust defense of U.S. intervention in Libya, said we can be successful in Afghanistan, but he pointedly did not say victory.
No, and that's a word he has been very careful not to use when talking about Afghanistan, because it's very murky, because defining victory in that particular war is hard to do. Instead, it's easier to talk about things like success, which is really a process. There's not an end that you can point to that people will measure you against. And the president has said, listen, we have been successful in our efforts to degrade al-Qaeda's capacity. Obviously, the bin Laden raid was a huge victory for the administration. And so the president is leaning heavily on that kind of momentum. The problem is senior administration officials and the president himself has argued that the ultimate goal in Afghanistan is to prevent that country from becoming again a safe haven from which insurgent networks could strike the United States. That is a tough argument to make, because when do you know that that is true? Mm. When is it true that Afghanistan is no longer at risk of that? And that's what critics are pointing to say if you go with that argument, that is an argument for a military occupation, in their words, in perpetuity. And that's where he's getting a lot of pushback from his own party on this issue. On Libya, you mentioned, interesting, he just wouldn't go there when pressed to define whether or not the War Powers Act was constitutional,
indeed,
whether the U.S. Military intervention as part of NATO was constitutional. He just said, I don't have to. It doesn't meet the test. The administration has been firm in insisting that the operation in Libya are not hostilities. And that they are limited in scope and time. The problem is we don't see an end to that at this point. Critics of that war say Gaddafi is still around. The International Criminal Court has identified him as someone who's committed war crimes, but he's still around in the offing. The president says he has to go.
Hey, you've been listening to President Obama's news conference just a few moments ago in the East Room at the White House. The president touched on the economy, on Afghanistan, Libya, and even the issue of gay marriage. He said that he was optimistic that his administration could reach a deal on debt and deficit reduction with congressional Republicans soon. He also addressed the debt ceiling issue, saying that the yellow light is flashing and that if the United States does default, the consequences for the U.S. economy will be significant. Thanks to our guests, NPR national political correspondent Mara Lyason, our economics correspondent John Idstey, and our national security correspondent Rachel Martin. The president is scheduled to meet with Democratic leaders later today to talk more about debt negotiations. Stay with NPR News and NPR.org for the latest on those talks. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News.